In the first hour of the show today, we will be talking about the life and career of Christopher Columbus. He is certainly best known for his first achievement, his first voyage, the one that happened in 1492. The man himself, though, Christopher Columbus, believed that his greatest voyage was his last, his fourth, and certainly in many ways it was the most challenging. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Martin Dugard about his new book, The Last Voyage of Columbus. It is published by Little Brown. He is a New York Times bestselling author of a number of nonfiction works. He has written also for publications including Esquire, Outside, Sports Illustrated, and GQ. The book is out just recently, and if you're interested, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. And of course, this morning in this part of the show, as we talk, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Dugard, hello.
Yeah, hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, yeah.
We certainly appreciate it. As I mentioned, I think it's fair to say that probably most people will know Columbus for the first trip, and perhaps also will know that he made several. But he himself believed that this, the fourth and final voyage, was his greatest. Why did he think of everything that he did? Why did he think that this was the most significant thing?
Well, if you break his four voyages down, the first one is when he discovered the Americas. The second is when he brought colonists over to begin the colonization. The third is when he discovered South America. But the fourth voyage was a very emotional voyage for him. It was this voyage of redemption, this one last chance to prove that there was a westward passage to the Indies. And in the process of actually disproving that theory, he sailed further and accomplished more than he had on any of his previous voyage. And I think, and also, he had so many hardships on the voyage. It was such a test of his nautical abilities that he was able to pull through the whole thing. I think gave him immense satisfaction as he lay on his deathbed.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I want to talk about here right at the beginning is to dismiss the notion that perhaps some people might still have that at the time of Columbus that people believed that the world was flat. And that's not true. They knew the world was round, but they didn't know how big it was. And that's where perhaps the one uncertainty lay. It was not unreasonable, this idea that Columbus had, that you could get to the to East Asia by sailing west, but the big question was just how far was it, and a lot of people disagreed. He apparently thought it was not as far as some other people thought, and that really was the big issue, not whether or not it could be done at all.
No, sailors knew. I mean, actually, ever since Aristotle, people knew that the world was round, and a simple sailor could tell you that too. When a ship sails over the horizon, it goes hull down. You know, the hull disappears, and then the sails disappear. Which wouldn't be true if the world was flat. So the sailors knew. The thing is, though, the world was so vast, and that was Columbus's huge miscalculation, that people didn't even find out for decades after Columbus. That's the reason that when Magellan sailed across the Pacific 20 years after Columbus's last voyage, he ran out of provisions, you know, halfway across, and his men were eating shoe leather. They had no idea how vast the Pacific Ocean really was.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the ancient Greeks had actually estimated the size of the Earth and had come very close, and yet that knowledge apparently had been lost, and so that people in the time of Columbus really had no idea what the true size of the Earth was.
I know, isn't that amazing? That just blows my mind when you think that the Greeks were so on top of things centuries before.
Mm-hmm. You have one line in the book, and early in the book, that I think is interesting because it sums up a lot in a few words, and perhaps the rest of the book, in a way, is devoted to fleshing that statement out. But I'm thinking of the very first line of the first chapter, which goes like this: Columbus's problems began, ironically, with his greatest success. What do you mean by that?
Well, he had nowhere to go but down. You have to remember, Columbus was not well liked by the courtiers in Spain. He was an outsider. He was a necessary evil. The Spanish had a minimal sailing tradition, and so they had to turn to this outsider, this Italian, to come in and help them fill the royal coffers, which were depleted by war. And when he found the Andes, when he discovered what would later become the Americas, he was revered in 1492. He was received. He was actually begged to come and sit next to Ferdinand and Isabella in the royal court, which is unheard of. But after that, things just went wrong. You know, he was a terrible administrator. I mean, he was a brilliant navigator, but he was a terrible administrator. And the next thing, of course, the Spanish sovereigns wanted to do was to send people to the Americas to begin accumulating gold and wealth. And that's where he failed, because the people that came with him didn't want to work. They didn't want to really invest themselves in this new land. They began grumbling. They sent reports back that that Columbus was, you know, was making them work too hard, and he was a very unjust man. And you know, the seeds of discontent were sown.
When he left, did the rulers of Spain actually think that he could do it?
Ferdinand did not. Ferdinand was, he was a vile, evil little man, and he didn't like Columbus one bit. Isabella was more optimistic. She had been, I wouldn't say literally seduced, but kind of emotionally seduced by Columbus and his passion and his belief and his dreams. You have to remember, you know, we think of Columbus now as this kind of archaic, kind of fusty 500-year-old person, but you know, when he lived, he was this, think of the most intense person you know, with great visions and great hopes and great dreams, whose personal life is a train wreck, and that's Columbus. So when he spoke with Isabella, she invested herself in his dreams, and even though she had doubts that he could succeed, she had high hopes. She thought that there was something to what he was saying. So when he left in 1492, Ferdinand thought there was nothing to it. Isabella was really hoping there was something out there. The ironic thing is, when Columbus comes back and he has found the New World, it's Ferdinand who sees right away, in a very Machiavellian fashion, that this is a place to be exploited. This is a place to increase the wealth of Spain, and he's the one who avidly begins pushing the idea of reaping all the wealth of this new land. Mm.
And I guess that also immediately presents a problem for them, for the king and the queen, because of the extravagant sorts of promises that they made to Columbus about his reward should he succeed. They promised that essentially he would be the ruler of whatever he discovered, that he would receive a very significant portion of the profits from the voyage and anything that he found and anything he discovered. And it seemed that immediately, as soon as he got back, that Ferdinand at least began to reconsider the deal, and they tried to find ways to nudge Columbus out.
Well, exactly. And remember, it all goes back to him being two things, an outsider and a commoner. And when Ferdinand found this wealth, the contract they had signed, which was called the Capitulations of Santa Fe, and it was signed on the plains of Santa Fe, just after the fall of Granada in 1492, basically it gave Columbus half of the New World's wealth. He was their business partner. He was almost a sovereign nation unto himself. And I think when Ferdinand signed that deal, he thought, you know, what's really out there? It's just a bunch of ocean. But when he realized that there was a lot of wealth, he slowly began chipping away at Columbus's power. You know, and even though he was the king, Spain had a very involved legal system. So Ferdinand couldn't just decree that he had to take it away from Columbus. He had to circumvent the system, find ways to literally steal it back from Columbus, and he did.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that then this interpretation of the exact letter of the agreement, or perhaps it was some finessing on the side of the royals there, probably also added the pressure on Columbus for him to continue to sail, to explore, to see what he could find, because they essentially said to him, okay, you can have the profits from everything that you had discovered prior to a particular date, and then anything after that, anything you personally discover, you can have the share of the profits. But if it should happen to be something else, even if it's in the territory that's claimed by Spain, you're not going to get any of that. So it made it very important for Columbus himself personally to continue to be out there as much as he could, because in order for him to profit, he would personally have to have made the discovery himself.
Right, right. You know, and it's interesting, because Columbus was an intensely loyal individual. And even though it had taken him years to convince the Spanish sovereigns to let him take these voyages, to give him the ships and the men to take this one big gamble across the Atlantic, he was really very, very beholden to them. But once he realized what Ferdinand was doing, once he realized that Ferdinand was trying to take everything back from him, he almost became a freelance sailor, if you will. Basically, he realized he was in it for himself. He couldn't really trust them, and he had to be very, very careful. And so, like you say, he began pushing further and further into the unknown to find as much new land as he could before somebody else did.
Yeah. And I suppose that also what happened was that over a very short period of time, more ships headed out. The Portuguese made their way to India by sailing the other way, sailing around the bottom of Africa, demonstrating that that could be done. And it got to the point where perhaps what Columbus had done in 1492 just wasn't that special anymore. And so perhaps for both reasons of his image, his self-image perhaps, and also for the possibility of making money, that he was driven to keep going and also to go further and to try to because indeed also he did believe that he could find this way somehow by going west around this land that he had bumped into to eventually get to India.
Yeah, and you have to remember too that it's really interesting the way it shakes out that Portugal controlled the trade routes going to the east. They controlled Africa. They controlled the route to India. Italy and France controlled the Mediterranean. France and Britain controlled the North Atlantic. So Spain could only sail west. That was the only way they could go to find wealth. And Spain really needed wealth. They had just fought these wars of unification to make it a single country. They had just fought these wars against the Moors to kick them out of Spain. And they'd hired all these mercenaries from other nations to come in and fight their wars for them. They really had no money. And ironically, though, when Columbus discovered the New World in 1492, the sailors on his ships, it's like 6 degrees of separation. The sailors who came with him, they saw the way, they learned how to get there, and they were the ones in subsequent years that asked for and received permission from the sovereigns to lead their own voyages of discovery to the New World, because Columbus had shown them the way.
Mm. The one of the things that he was trying to do, in addition to enlarging his personal bank account with the fourth voyage, was he had this idea that he could find this passage to East Asia, and eventually gave up on that, although continued to try to accumulate what gold he could. And on this fourth voyage, moved from the Caribbean across to Central America to what is today would be the coast of Honduras, and then down as far as Panama. Although I guess he continued, did he continue to believe that what this was the coast of China?
He did. He did. He said that, it's in his journals, but if you look at it, I think there comes a point, and it's a really tragic moment in Columbus's career. And it's the point where he realizes that there is no passage to the Orient. And it's where he turns back, because he's filled in all the blanks on the map. And ironically, he's the spot where he turns around, where he comes to this low point, is now the mouth of the Panama Canal on the Caribbean side. So, I mean, he was close enough to the passage, he just didn't know how to get across. But he has this moment of depression, this real low period where he just realizes that, his life's quest is over, it's done. And I think in his heart of hearts, he knew that it wasn't China. There were no palaces, there were no great cities. But he had to keep putting up that front because, when he went back to Spain, he didn't want to sail back home and be seen as a failure and mocked. He'd been mocked and reviled for 20 years. I think when he came back to Spain, he had to put up this front that, yes, I found the coast of China. I just didn't find the great cities that I'd hoped to find.
Mm-hmm. And he also, one of the things that he was struggling with was poor health, was the strain of all of these years. He was not a young man. He didn't live all that much longer after coming home from this second voyage. Did he feel that he was at the end of his life?
Well, he must have, because he spent a lot of time in his cabin because he had rheumatoid arthritis. He had ophthalmia from staring too long at the sea. His eyes actually bled sometimes from looking at the sea too long. He had gout. He was probably impotent because his his years of liaisons with women were no more. I think at some point he was almost, there were bipolar moments during that voyage, and he knew it was the end. But in typical Columbus fashion, he was ever the optimist. He hoped he actually hoped for a fifth voyage, but by the time he got back to Spain at the end of the fourth voyage, he'd been so beaten up by all the calamities of the fourth voyage. I mean, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. He was in no condition to even get on horseback to go see the king, let alone, you know, lead one more voyage into the unknown.
Our guest in this hour of Focus Friday, Martin Dugard, has authored a book which looks at the fourth and final voyage of Columbus, and the title of the book is The Last Voyage of Columbus. It is published by Little Brown, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What do we know of his early life and his introduction into life at sea?
Well, he was, the records say, and there is, people are arguing this, contesting this, but let's just go with what we know. We know that he was born in Genoa somewhere around 1451, somewhere between August and October 1451. His father was a wool merchant. His mother had this lovely name, Susanna Fontana Rosa. It just kind of rolls off your tongue. He was probably the oldest of several children, but they're not sure if there was another child before him. What we do know is that his two brothers, Diego and Bartholomew, proceeded to travel with him on several of his voyages in the years to come. And somewhere in his teenage years, like many youth in Genoa, which is one of the great seafaring ports of the time, he put to sea. He probably sailed around the Mediterranean, sailed down to Venice, maybe sailed over to Africa. And, you know, and pretty soon the voyages became longer and longer. At one point, he finally moves to Portugal, which was the hotbed of navigation. You know, if you wanted to be a navigator in those days, you went to Portugal. It's like nowadays, if you want to be a software engineer, you go to, you know, the Cupertino. Back then, it was the place to be was Portugal. And being a navigator, being a cartographer, those were really sexy occupations, and it was the real cutting edge stuff. And so Columbus and Bartholomew both moved to Lisbon, and that's where Columbus does some really foundational work in his career. That's where he sails down the coast of Africa. That's where he sails up to Iceland and to Britain and to Ireland, and that's where he learns how to navigate on the open seas and how to take a caravel, which was this Spanish sailing ship, this little small Spanish sailing ship designed for open water sailing. He learns how to bring it in close to land, which would later serve him well when he's trying to chart the lands that he discovers. And then sometime around 1480, all of a sudden he decides that he's had enough of this rogue seafaring life. He's already been married, and his wife has died. He's got one son out of this marriage, and he decides that he's going to find the money to go west to find this passage to the Orient. And instead of going to the Spaniards first, he goes to the Portuguese, and the Portuguese laugh at him. They basically say, "No, that you're foolish." But then they also secretly send ships westward to see if Columbus is correct. And the captains turn back in terror because the ocean is so vast. And Columbus by then has moved on to the Spaniards, and in 1492 they finally give him permission.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We'll start with someone listening in Indiana this morning, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. You mentioned that by him doing that, his fellow sailors could also do the same thing because they learned how to do it. Just in a general sense, I was wondering, of course, we never learned these things, at least I'm pretty sure in high school textbooks we wouldn't. I don't know about the college because I never took any history for that period. But were there other people, whether they were, learned under Columbus, who reached the New World, but it didn't make much noise, so to speak? And if there were some, were there any ones that were sort of important?
There were. Well, in 1495, John Cabot sailed out of England, and he was also from Genoa, like Columbus, and he sailed along the North America, the coast of North America, up by what is now New England. But the Spanish explorers who followed in Columbus's wake did some remarkable things. Columbus, for instance, discovered South America, but they were the ones who actually charted much of the coast of South America and came in contact with many of the Indians in South America, the Carib especially, and waged war with them and discovered some of the wealth. And they kind of helped this process of charting, you know, the Caribbean Rim. And then Juan de la Cosa actually went up and discovered and charted what is now Florida. So you have this slow expansion, but none of these people were really as well known as Columbus, or at least they aren't today. But back then, they were relatively well known because the seafaring community was so small.
All right, let's go to another caller here, Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a couple of questions. Number one, and I'll take the answers off the air.
Okay.
But the first one was, weren't his diaries, the diaries that we have now that we do research on, are copies because the originals were lost? That's my first question. And then my second question there is, if you could talk a little bit about that. And then my second question was that there's been, because of the way that he wrote and apparently from what I understand, the Spanish of the diaries that we have, the Spanish is kind of awkward, so there's like real knowledge as to where he originally was from. So if you can address those issues, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, sure. It's interesting, because after Columbus died, the Spanish began the slow process to kind of deny his existence. They slowly began to discredit him in the Spanish court. So there got to a point where Columbus was almost a non-person within 10 to 15 years of his death. So many of his artifacts, including his journals, were either sold or lost or totally disappeared. So much of what we read now are copies. There are still several original documents, but many are copies. And it's interesting you mention about the way he wrote Spanish, because Spanish was his second language. But, you know, remember, he's an Italian, and he also spoke Latin. So if you read his stuff, he kind of weaves in a mixture of the three languages. And he has his own little code. If you look at the way he signs his name, he's got a funny little way of signing his name that has led people to believe that there are conspiracies, and there's, you know, kind of like a Da Vinci code, so to speak, in the way that he signs his name. And, you know, which I think is kind of cool, because it kind of adds to this air of mystery around Columbus. And I think the reason he did all these things was because the Spanish were working so hard to discredit him. At a certain point, he realized he needed to be a little bit more savvy than he was appearing, and he began to be very, very careful about what he knew and how he showed it to other people. But, yeah, his Spanish was very clumsy because it wasn't his first language. But all told, he spoke Italian, Latin, Portuguese, and Spanish.
Well, this is an interesting story, because apparently there are all kinds of people who have tried to claim him. Certainly, for Italians and Italian-Americans, he is a hero. Apparently, some Basque historians have said he was a Basque. Some people have said he was from Corsica. Some people have argued that he was Jewish. Is there really doubt about his heritage, where he's born, what his ethnicity was, and so forth?
Actually, there is. You know, it's funny, my mother claims that he's Irish.
Well, he had red hair, but that might have something to do with it.
Yeah, you know, red hair and freckles. Well, here's the thing. You know, everybody, the records show that Columbus is from Genoa. But there is evidence that the people of Genoa fabricated those records back at the start of the 19th century, when Columbus kind of makes this reemergence onto the historical scene. he's been unknown for so long that when he came back into favor, Genoa was really quick to claim him. And so some people say that everything was fabricated, that his birth records, that his his parents' ancestry, that all that was fabricated. And so there's some people say that he was that he was Jewish, which may be true. And there's some people say he was the son of a Spanish nobleman, which I don't believe is true. All of this could be answered very simply just by examining his DNA, which they're trying to do right now in Granada. They've exhumed his body. They're taking bone chips, and they're trying to get the DNA. But his body has broken down so much that they really can't figure out, you know, that we don't technologically have the ability to divine whether he is Jewish or Italian or, you know, whatnot, or Irish, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think it's going to be interesting when that day comes, because Columbus he's this enigmatic figure, and I wouldn't be surprised that even in death, if he didn't have some mysteries, that he would be, you know, passing along to us.
Yeah, it's again, one of the interesting parts of his story is the fact that even after he was dead, he didn't stop traveling. His remains were picked up by people and taken all over the place, and he actually had been buried in several different places.
Yeah, he traveled more in death than he did in life. It's pretty funny. Now, he was originally buried in the northern part of Spain, and then his body was moved to the southern part of Spain, and then per his own wishes, he was moved to the Dominican Republic in the cathedral in Santo Domingo. When the Spanish lost control of Hispaniola and the Dominican Republic and the French came in, those remains were moved to Cuba and then later moved back to Spain. So if you go to the big cathedral in Seville, there's this huge sepulcher with, you know, Columbus's remains and the remains of his brother and his son. Interestingly, though, the people of the Dominican Republic claim that when Columbus's body was moved to Cuba, it was the wrong Columbus that was moved. It was either his brother or his son that was moved to the Dominican Republic, and that Columbus himself, that his remains actually stayed in the Dominican Republic. And so if you go to Spain, you've got this big Columbus gravesite in Seville. If you go to the Dominican Republic, there is this huge monument to Columbus, a huge lighthouse that they believe holds Columbus's remains. And again, this is something that could be solved with the DNA, but the people of the Dominican Republic refuse to allow the DNA to be the body to be exhumed so they can examine that DNA. And I think because it's a huge tourism thing for them, and they don't want to lose that.
We have another caller here we'll get to in just a second. I'm a little bit past the midpoint here, so I should introduce again our guest, Martin Dugard. He's authored a book entitled The Last Voyage of Columbus, which looks at the fourth and final voyage of Christopher Columbus. It's out fairly recently. It's published by Little Brown. He's the author of a number of books, all having to do with adventure, travel, exploration. He's written about Captain Cook and about Stanley and Livingston. He's also written for Esquire, Outside, Sports Illustrated, and GQ. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And I think we have someone here to talk with in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have read some books lately that caller prior brought up the question of who else did the exploring. And are you familiar with Gavin Menzies' book?
About the Chinese?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the current National Geographic has a major article on the same guy. They don't go into anything beyond him exploring the east coast of Africa. But it's interesting to read that, and these, you know, it's kind of confirmation of some of the things that Menzies said about the huge treasure ships they had and the way he traces artifacts that he says were left. And one of the interesting comments he has in there is that in Columbus's diaries, when he went to Iceland, which you mentioned a while ago, he says in his writings from there that there's a mention that the Chinese had been to Iceland.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
So that's one of the pieces of evidence that he uses, along with a lighthouse of unknown age, which is of Chinese dimension and style, which sits in Connecticut on the coast.
Oh, that's interesting.
And different stela, written in different languages, which are left all over the country. And he includes some DNA work, not on people so much, but as on animals and plants, which he says were transmitted or transferred around the globe by the Chinese in these earlier voyages. And in both his book and in the National Geographic thing, it mentions that with the change in emperors in China, the whole idea of going out into the world was abandoned, and the ships were all destroyed, and most of the records were destroyed, too. So we don't have a continuing history of him as such as we have with the New World coming from Columbus. But Columbus is a fascinating character, but this is a totally different perspective on who got where first.
No, you know, I think there's a lot to that, and I don't... Columbus didn't, let's put it this way, Columbus did not get to the New World first. You know,
that's for sure.
What makes Columbus important is that he stayed.
Right.
You know, the Irish got there, you know, with Brendan, the navigator. The Vikings were there. The Chinese were likely there. All those people got there, and everyone kind of came, saw it, and turned around and went back home.
Right.
What made Columbus special was that Columbus came there, he went back home, but then he brought people back with him. He
right.
said, you know, come on with me, you know, we're going to do something special. And he was able to make it stick.
There's another interesting connection there in that this guy thinks that there was somebody from, I can't remember right off it, but he was a European who was in the Indian ports and may have brought some of the Chinese maps back for the people in Italy and Spain and Portugal to base some of their maps on. And he points to things such as Strait of Magellan. When Magellan was trying to go around the southern tip of South America, he says that there's a log by one of his officers that gives the latitude of the strait before they ever left Europe.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
Which he says must have come from the Chinese.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, that makes a lot of sense because the Straits of Magellan are really tortuous, and you actually have to know they were there to want to sail through them because it's a really kind of a funny little passageway. You've got to know your way through it. So that's really cool. That's interesting.
And he says the Chinese had to learn to navigate by the southern stars because they knew how to navigate by the northern stars. And there's one of the major southern stars, which basically is right over the Falkland Islands, and at least it was at that time, and that was used as so that island area is a center point from which they describe things.
Oh, wow.
It's a very fascinating book anyway, but we'll see. Some people have discounted it, and others, you know, I'm just seeing this thing now, National Geographic, which kind of at least gives credence to the fact that they existed, and these huge treasure ships existed, and they were exploring during this period of the early 1400s, anyway.
No, I really honestly think there's something to that. And I think that it's going to be one of those things that further research will show much more, you know, and kind of bring more of this to light, you know, so that people will appreciate the complexity of what the Chinese accomplished.
Well, I thank the caller. Let's go on to next caller here, Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I didn't come in at the very beginning, unfortunately, but who were the men that came with Columbus, did you say? I understood that the king gave him convicts or people out of jail.
Yeah, some of the people who came in, there was a second.
They were not very nice men.
not everybody. It's kind of funny because when they came back, when he colonized in 1493, some of the people on there were people who were given the choice between prison and being a colonist. Remember, when Columbus came back, he brought somewhere between 1,200 and 1,700 people with him, which is quite a bunch of people for the small caravels. There wasn't a single woman in that group, so they asked all these men to go form this new world. And among them were artisans and craftsmen and priests, but there were also quite a few who were given the choice between going to prison, and this is during the Inquisition, which was not a good time to be in prison, or going to the new world, and many of them chose the new world.
So what kind of people were these? I mean, were they roughnecks or were they, you know, or a mixture?
Yeah, I think it's more, I think it's a mixture. I think that's...
Okay. Also, I heard that after some time, you know, after many voyages, the king sent his, I don't know what you call them, I can't remember the word, but, you know, his wealthy friends to Spain, I mean, to the New World, and they were reaping all different kinds of rewards and doing all kinds of horrid things in America, and then were blaming Columbus, and then because they were Spaniards and Columbus was Italian, so that was, you know, easy to take, that Columbus was brought back to Spain and was put in chains until he died in a dungeon.
Well,
and never received 1 cent of any of his contract or his family. That was the reason why he went there, was to make money for his family.
Well, it's interesting, and there's the what you just said. There's a lot of that is there's kind of a myth around Columbus. So to kind of go back, he was doing it to make money for his family. He had two sons. He wanted to provide for them after he died, and the Spanish king did begin this campaign to take the New World away from Columbus, and particularly Governor Ovando, who succeeded Columbus as the head of the Indies. His atrocities against the Indians were horrendous. He basically began a genocide that has been largely blamed on Columbus, and Columbus had nothing to do with it. The point where Columbus is thrown into chains is the end of the third voyage. It's during that pivotal time when the people of the Indies, these people who have gone over there, are very unhappy with Columbus because, you know, Columbus is a guy who had to work for everything he got. He came from relatively modest beginnings, and he worked every day of his life. He was intensely, you know, labor oriented, and many of the colonists who went to the New World didn't want to work. They thought they were just going to find gold lying on the ground. They're very unhappy with that, and they wrote letters back to the king and queen asking for Columbus to be replaced. So when Columbus is finally replaced, instead of just sending him back to Spain, they put him in chains, and they put him on a ship, and they send him back. But he doesn't die then. What happens is he goes to Ferdinand and Isabella. He's in the Alhambra, which is this huge castle in Granada, and he falls on his knees before them inside their palace, and he begs for one last chance, for one last voyage to find this passage to the west. An amazing thing happens because as he's on his knees, he starts crying, just pleading. And he's this old man. You know, he's almost 50, which at that time was similar to being 75 or 80 now. He's gray-haired. He's got this arthritis, so he can barely get down on his knees. And he's a really pathetic, tragic character. And as he's on his knees crying, Isabella begins crying too, and she pretty much takes his hand and says, "It's going to be okay. We're going to give you the ships. You're going to have that one last chance." And so then that begets the fourth voyage, which is what my book is about. It's at the end of the voyage, when he finally returns home, that Columbus dies. But he's not in chains. He's on his deathbed, surrounded by his sons and some very good friends.
And he did accumulate some wealth for his family.
He did okay, and it's a great story because when the Spanish sovereign sent people over to replace Columbus and actually have him thrown in chains, again, we have the Spanish legal system that has a sense of fairness about it, and Columbus is allowed to send an accountant to get his share of the wealth and have that sent back to Spain. And that accountant succeeds in, you know, figuring out the exact amount of money that Columbus is owed, and when that amount of gold is placed on a ship to go back to Spain, it is one of the only ships that is not lost in the massive hurricane of 1502. And so all these other people lost their lives, many people lost their wealth. Columbus's wealth gets back to Spain okay, and this led many people to believe that he was somehow a soothsayer or a witch because he could cause this thing to happen.
That's one of the great pieces of luck that Columbus had. He, as you say, on this fourth voyage, he comes back across. He has this feeling that there's a serious storm brewing. He goes to Hispaniola to both to warn them and to say, "Look, I need some place to shelter with the ships." They said, "Beat it." They wouldn't even let him land. He did, in fact, go find a place to ride out the storm. The Spanish fleet headed out anyway. Most of them were lost, except this ship that had Columbus's fortune on it. And although his fleet of ships was battered, he didn't lose a single sailor as a result of that hurricane.
No, the thing people forget about Columbus, again, you got to kind of break the mold when you think about Columbus. He's such a polemic figure. And he, like I said, his personal life was a train wreck. But when he was on the seas, excuse me, when he was on the open ocean, he was brilliant, and they said he was so savvy that he could navigate by scent. And so when he was sailing into Hispaniola at the start of this fourth voyage, and he sees this storm brewing, you know, he's already seen two hurricanes in his life, and hurricanes are specific to the Caribbean. He knows there's something going on, and he can't wait to go tell that he wants to save the people of Santo Domingo. It's the city that he founded. He wants to prevent it from being destroyed. And they won't even allow him to sail into the port and get off his ship. And to his credit, he immediately takes his men. They sail, you know, westward along the coast. They find a small anchorage, and they ride out the storm. And it just shows what a brilliant seaman he was to have been able to not only anticipate the storm, but to take immediate action to take care of his men. I think a lesser man might have hung around Hispaniola to argue his case or to try to get ashore somehow. Instead, Columbus did. He knew there was a storm coming, and he took immediate action. And it just showed that when he needed to be, he could be decisive and brilliant.
Let's talk with someone here on cell phone. This is line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, is there a caller there?
I've been listening to the show from the beginning. And as a Native American person, I find it very interesting that all of this treachery, mendacity and greed and personal aggrandizement and all of the other kind of stuff surrounding what amounted to the opening of the door to the destruction of the Native population. And when I hear history, and it reminds me of when I was young in school, how it was all so impersonal, all so heroic. And yet the heroism and the billions of Columbus and all that kind of stuff were all in the service of greed and the destruction of the New World. And even though I respect the author and I believe what he says, et cetera, I just find it interesting in that the perspective of Native people who are just kind of an afterthought, and how you talk briefly about them being destroyed, et cetera. And as I understand it, wasn't there Columbus Diaries where he looked at the Native people and basically contemplated how easily they would be exploited? I just wanted to make sure I put that in there, because I hear so much about Western European history, and yet it destroyed the country of my ancestors, and I just think it's a tragic thing that happened. And I find it really interesting that it's surrounded by so much greed and duplicity, and in spite of what some people may have done as individuals, it just makes me realize how during our current administration, how all of the denial about how this country was founded, and it was ugly. So I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the call, and I think it's definitely a point that we need to talk about, the ugly side of what Columbus did. How do you think about that?
Well, I think a few things. First of all, I mean, I'm not his apologist. When I went in to write this book, I was very ambivalent about Columbus as a figure, and one of the reasons I specifically chose the Fourth Voyage is its navigational invent. And I think when it comes to the Native American population, Columbus definitely has a lot to answer for. He saw them as people to be exploited. Remember, Genoa was the leading slave port in the world at the time that he was growing up. So it was. You know, I think it's only natural that he would see the indigenous population as something to use as for laborers and for slaves. And you know, slavery was prevalent throughout the world at the time. But at the same time, Columbus showed a singular lack of compassion. But I think the mistake a lot of people make with Columbus is twofold. There's this belief that there was this idyllic life going on in North America amongst the Native American populations before Columbus arrived. There was warfare, there was slavery, there was just as much focus on stealing land and you know, as there was when Columbus, you know, amongst the Western Europeans. So the Native American populations weren't exactly living this idyllic life. And at the same time, too, what a lot of people do is they mistake, for instance, some people have made the connection between the war in Iraq or the genocide that the American government committed against the Native American population in the 19th century, which, to me, that's the true genocide. It's not what Columbus did by coming there and seeing these people as potential laborers, but it was the genocide of the 19th century by the American government. That's what we have to answer for. And I think that, but for some reason, because Columbus got here, because Columbus stayed, he has become the one person everybody focuses all their attention on, as if let's put it this way. If Columbus didn't get here, somebody else would have come here first. I mean, so somebody else would have come here afterward. And I think Columbus behaved in the manner that every person has behaves when they come to a new land and effectively conquer another civilization. And he did conquer civilization. And he didn't even try to merge their two civilizations. He was callous, and he was very cold to the Native American population. So, yeah, I think Columbus has a lot to answer for, but I think we have to differentiate between what Columbus personally did and what has come to pass because Columbus showed up here.
Hmm. We talked a little bit about the fourth voyage, about the fact that Columbus came back across the Atlantic to the Caribbean and then sailed over to what is today the coast of Honduras and then down Central America as far as Panama, and actually was at the point where if he had known how to get there, could have gone across and stood there and looked at the Pacific Ocean. He established a garrison there in, I guess that it is what is present-day Panama. Is it in Santa Maria de Belen?
Yes.
Continued to try to accumulate what he could, either by trade or by taking it, and got on the bad side of the indigenous people there and found himself in the middle of a war, or one of the parties to a war.
Yeah, no, he was part of a war. It's funny because there were many of the tribes, especially the Caribbean Indians and the Indians along the coast of Panama, were very warlike and very capable, and their tactics were nothing short of brilliant. And Columbus and his guys were sailors. They weren't necessarily yokels, but they weren't warriors. And so when they ran afoul of the Indians of Panama, the Indians not only matched them, you know, blow for blow, they amazed them with their stealth and their ability to wage war very much like guerrilla fighters. I mean, people who used the landscape, used surprise, used stealth to sabotage what the Spaniards were trying to do.
Yeah, and I suppose it was a combination of things, of perhaps his health, about his feeling on one hand that he'd not succeeded in finding the westward passage, that he had accumulated some wealth, his ships were in very bad condition. Was that sort of a combination of all of this that finally persuaded him, that is, he persuaded himself, he admitted to himself that that was that, and that it was time to go home?
Yeah, it was just everything was... It was just all going to hell, you know, for lack of a better term. You know, he had found, you know, what he was trying to do with Santa Maria de Belen was to found a new colony, kind of a new Santo Domingo, a new Genoa, if you will. He wanted this big trade port. He saw it as a place where there was literally lots of gold up in the hills. They had found so much of it. You know, the Indians were wearing it around their neck as necklaces and making mirrors out of it. And Columbus was hoping to make that a new civilization, but you know, the story is that as he sailed away, he realized that he had forgotten to fill his water casks. And so, as he went back to fill the water casks, the men he had left behind to start this new settlement were under attack from the native population, and they were getting destroyed. And you know, after the battle, after he's lost a number of men, after his own brother is almost killed in that thing, Columbus realizes that you know it's fruitless. He's got to do something. He effectively gives up at that point, and he makes a course back to Spain, but his ships are sinking, and instead he has to turn and he runs into Jamaica, where he spends a year being shipwrecked.
That's another. It seems that as you say, it's just one thing after another. The ships by this point were in such bad condition that he seemed to think that he could actually sail home in these ships.
Yeah,
although clearly they were not up to it.
Yeah, you've got to remember, a caravel is tiny. It's about the size of a Greyhound bus, and he has started off with four ships, and by this time he was down to two, and so not only is it tiny, not only do you have the crew of four ships crammed into into two vessels, but so much water was seeping in because of shipworms that the water was actually lapping up over the gunwales. The decks were almost even with the water. When the men suspected Columbus was trying to actually sail home to Spain, they pretty much tried to mutiny right then. And he knew that the smart thing to do was get them to Hispaniola. He doesn't make it to Hispaniola. And it's interesting, you know, when I wrote this book, usually when you write a book, there's an incident or two which is fascinating, which kind of gives the story its peak, and then you kind of taper off to the climax, and you can kind of quietly, you know, end your story. But the thing about this voyage is that there was just boom, 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 boom. You know, one thing after another. You know, there's the hurricane, there's the Indian attack, there's the shark attacks, there's the ship sinking, there's the mutiny, there's the battle between his men. It's just one calamity after another. And Columbus rode this thing out. And again, going back to your initial question, I mean, I think that's why he called it the High Voyage, because he survived so much on this voyage. And basically, but instead of returning home to Spain as this conquering hero, he came back viewed pretty much as a failure. And so whatever satisfaction he took from this voyage had to be personal.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. We're at the end of the time. You want to read the story, look for the book. We've mentioned it. It's titled The Last Voyage of Columbus, published by Little Brown, by our guest Martin Dugard. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks very much for having me.